But today we have, I think, a very topical question, and one which has certainly stirred a lot of thoughts around the Western world in particular. And that is the question we're asking: is the age of WikiLeaks and the new media, what does it mean for the future of diplomacy and democracy? We live in an age of freedom of information, but I don't think that even those of us who were very supportive of the concept of freedom of information quite foresaw how the new technology was going to make that freedom even more extensive than any of us imagined. And it will be interesting to hear from our panellists how they think that that will affect the way that diplomacy takes place and indeed how democracy conducts itself. We have three very distinguished panellists today. Joe Johnson, on my right, is the Member of Parliament for Orpington. He's the brother of someone we occasionally see on television, but we'll leave that aside for today's purposes. He was, until he was elected last May, an associate editor of the Financial Times and head of the Lex column. He remains a contributing editor of the Financial Times. He's now a member of the Public Accounts Committee. His special regional specialisms relate to India and France, where he lived and worked during four successive foreign postings for the Financial Times between 2001 and 2008. He is co-author with Martin Orange of The Man Who Tried to Buy the World, Jean-Marie Messier, and The Rise and Fall of Vivendi Universal. That was published in 2003. I think he has a unique outlook on this subject, which we'll be discussing today, and I look forward to hearing from him. And then on my left, on my far right, sorry, we have Gideon Rachman, who is the chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. His book, Zero Sum Future, was published by Simon & Schuster in February this year. He writes a weekly column on foreign affairs as well as an FT blog. And in 2010, he was named Foreign Commentator of the Year in Britain's annual Comment Awards. He's also a visiting fellow at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. And finally, on my left, we have Sir David Richmond, who is a distinguished British diplomat for more than 30 years, in a career which included postings to Baghdad, Brussels and New York, where he worked on the UN Security Council. In 2000, he became the first UK representative to the European Union's Political and Security Committee in Brussels and was involved in the creation of the European Security and Defence Policy. In 2003, he returned to Baghdad, where he'd been 20 years before, and was later appointed UK Special Representative for Iraq. In his last posting, he was Director General for Defence and Intelligence and a member of the Foreign Office Board, and he now works as a consultant for Bell Pottinger. I will be calling them in that order, but I'm sure you agree with me we have a very distinguished panel. I'm going to start by asking Joe Johnson if he will address us for about 8 minutes.
Thank you very much indeed. Shall I stand?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much indeed, and I'm delighted to be here. A very kind introduction. The title of the talk today is very, very broad. In fact, it's dauntingly broad, and I'm going to try and focus my thoughts on why I welcomed the arrival of a very disruptive and anarchic force such as WikiLeaks in our public life. In my view, I think we need to look at the origins of WikiLeaks and why it's emerged in the way it has. In my view, it's come into being principally as a response to the fact that foreign policy is so woefully under-scrutinised in the UK and in many other countries around the world. The key designated media and parliamentary watchdogs normally charged with scrutinising foreign policy have, in many countries, basically given up on the job. WikiLeaks has stepped up to the plate to do it for them. It's gained legitimacy because the various leaked cables have revealed, in the eyes of the public, wrongdoing, war crimes, corruption, hypocrisy, greed, espionage, double dealing, and the cynical exercise of power on a truly wondrous scale. Now, by exposing what the French call secret de polichinelle, things that are widely known but hushed up by an elite media and political class, WikiLeaks has given the unwashed masses a glimpse of what governments do in their name. Now, to give some flesh to this thesis, I'd like to focus on the UK, as that's clearly the country that I happen to know best. In the UK, we've got an ever more parochial media. The media industry in the UK has, as you all know, been slashing the number of foreign correspondents and the space available for foreign news and analysis for a number of years, with a few exceptions, such as the FT, where I was lucky to work for 12 years alongside Gideon for part of them. With the exception of the FT, I would say, our print media has basically given up on international news in terms of covering it in a systematic and, you know, serious fashion. The coverage of the Arab world in the last few weeks has been largely undertaken as a result by what the profession knows as firemen, people who are flown in to cover a crisis situation, rather than by reporters who are rooted in the region permanently as foreign correspondents. Now, that's because the foreign correspondent who has the time to burrow his way into a society, to cultivate the trust of strangers, to follow meandering trails, and to dig behind layers of diplomatic spin and government propaganda, is now a very much an endangered species for a number of reasons. First, cost. Staffing a basic foreign bureau is increasingly unaffordable. Typically costs between $200,000 and $300,000 a year for a simple one-man or woman operation with the supporting infrastructure that comes with it, office space, cars, and so on. War zones evidently will cost much, much more than that. Very difficult to justify at a time of falling circulation and falling profitability across the news industry. Second reason, Google News and the growth of easily accessed news aggregator sites have convinced many newspaper editors that foreign news is now a commodity that doesn't warrant investment in original content. In other words, newspaper editors can run small briefs, news in brief digest columns that are taken generally from the wire services or simply copied and pasted from the internet, leaving their paid-for staff reporters to focus on the issue, the areas where the paper really is trying to differentiate itself, normally domestic news of one sort or other, celebrity comings and goings, and inevitably sport. Third reason, the accessibility of information sources via the internet has also led to a shift in power away from the foreign correspondent back to the newsrooms, in this case generally in London. Knowledge, of course, is power, and the more information that the central news desk has or believes it has, the less reliant those on the desk feel they are on the knowledge and expertise of the correspondent on the ground. Fourth reason is that public interest in foreign news is in steady decline. Now, that's only partly in function of the fact that less of it is being produced and there's less of it to read. There is a theory that since the end of the Cold War, it's become much more difficult for newspaper editors to present foreign news in a way that has a clear, understandable narrative for a mass audience, and that may be contributing to this long-term decline in public interest in foreign affairs. After 1989, it became much more difficult to put military coups, dictatorships, the wrangling and complicated wars in a context that was immediately recognisable to a domestic audience. Now, the result of all of that, as a recent report by the Media Standards Trust has documented, is a shocking decline of international reporting in the British press, doubtless mirrored in other countries. Now, even though we live in now what is a far more globalised world than the one of 1979, when Media Standards Trust has done a before and after analysis of the state of our newspaper industries, it's evident that international coverage in the UK media has fallen drastically, both in absolute and in relative terms, over the past 30 years. A few very quick statistics, as they did an absolutely spectacular job of analysing several months' worth of newspapers in 1979 and 2009. International news has fallen by 40% in terms of the absolute number of stories covered in UK newspapers, even as newspapers themselves ballooned in size because of a proliferation in supplements. If you compare the Times of today with the Times of 30 years ago, it's a totally different animal. I mean, the Times of 30 years ago was perhaps 24 pages long. The Times of today, when you add it all up, you can on some days get over 100 pages. In relative terms, international news has lost share, therefore, representing now only 11% of all articles in the papers, compared to over 20% 30 years ago. And that's been mirrored, or that's been accompanied at the same time, by the positioning of these articles. Whereas it was very common to see foreign news in the first 10 pages of the newspapers 3 decades ago, the frequency with which they now do so has fallen by 80% over that period. To give you a sort of a feel for the types of changes that have occurred, in September 1979, the Daily Mirror, a tabloid, broke the story of the killing fields of Cambodia to the world, devoting the front page and 12 others to John Pilger's report of the on the horrors of the Khmer Rouge. Quite unthinkable to think to imagine the Daily Mirror doing that sort of story today. Indeed, on the 22nd of April 2010, which, if you recall, was the day of the foreign affairs debate between Nick Clegg, Gordon Brown and David Cameron, when you would imagine that there would be more of a focus on foreign affairs than normal, Britain's two largest circulation dailies, The Sun and The Daily Mail, had a combined total of just three foreign stories between them, adding up to a grand length of 257 words. And the longest of these stories was about Michelle Obama showing off her biceps to a class of school children. That gives you a sense, I think, of the way our interest in foreign affairs in the newspapers has changed. Now, the new media side of our story comes into play here. Proliferation of new media and edited news and news internet news sites and the relentless growth of peer-to-peer connectivity has paradoxically exacerbated this trend and been a diversity killer for foreign news. Edited news sources have very much dwindled in number. There are now large areas of the world that are simply not covered by a British correspondent, unless that person works for Reuters, AP, or the BBC. Yes, new technologies and internet delivery have enabled the rise of citizen journalism, but as anyone who has tried to follow the news through Twitter knows, these Twitter feeds simply cannot replace the crucial functions of professional on-the-ground journalism undertaken by people of judgment, able to apply editorial filters to the noise and bias around them. Without dedicated reporters on the ground, we have nobody who is trained to bear witness to events, to record, illustrate, and above all, question what is happening. So that's half of the story. That's why WikiLeaks has found for itself a niche in the realm of foreign affairs. It's no accident. It is a direct response, in my view, to the fact that the mainstream media no longer does the job of scrutinizing foreign policy. Now, if scrutiny of foreign policy is deficient in the UK media, the other watchdog, Parliament, is, I'm afraid, performing no better. The world might now be debating the uprisings in the Maghreb, but the mother of parliaments, I'm afraid, has barely noticed. The government has made just three brief statements since the crisis began in mid-December. The Prime Minister made one following his visit to Egypt, and the Speaker has called William Hague back to the Commons on two occasions to explain, first, why he had not banned the export of arms that could potentially be used to suppress pro-democracy protests, and then again yesterday, as you will have seen, to explain why last week's special mission to make contact with opposition forces in Libya did not appear quite to go to plan. Now, such statements are certainly better than nothing, but they're no substitute for real debate. They permit only short, single questions from MPs and very skillful and experienced ministers such as William Hague can easily parry them and bat them off without too much difficulty. It's hard, really, to strike a blow. Scheduled debates in foreign affairs are now very, very rare. There used to be a systematic, and I'm speaking as if I'm an old hand, but I'm told that there used to be systematic debates on foreign policy before every European Council meeting. I understand that it was a decision at the start of this Parliament to do away with that. That was one of the major forums for debate on foreign affairs. It no longer exists. Gradually, it seems to me, the Commons is following the media and turning its back on the world beyond our shores. It's also clear that the limited attention that MPs do give foreign affairs could certainly be better directed. At present, the view of the world from Westminster seems to me to be a curiously distorted one. I did an analysis of the 268 questions that MPs have put to the Foreign Secretary in the fixed slot for Foreign and Commonwealth Office questions that comes round once every five sitting weeks. And I'm afraid I was absolutely shocked by the result. In fact, it just confirmed what I thought, but the findings themselves are shocking. Essentially, the questions reflect hardly at all the way in which the world is moving. Entire sessions of FCO questions pass without meaningful reference to the BRICS. Brazil and Russia have been the subject between them of just two of the 268 oral questions asked so far this Parliament. India has done little better, generating three questions. All of them, however, have been on Kashmir none on its emergence as an economic power. China might now be the UK's second most important bilateral relationship after the US, but astonishingly, it has generated just 5 questions. And again, these two are invariably hostile, tending to focus on things, issues such as human rights, Tibet, and arms sales to Africa. In total, the BRIC economies have so far this parliament notched up just 12 oral questions between them, taking up less than 5% of the available airtime for scrutiny of foreign policy on the floor of the House. This is my long one. So if backbenchers were to be our geopolitical cartographers with responsibility for allocating the department's meagre resources, the BRICS would be a very low priority indeed. By contrast, there's extraordinary amount of interest in what amounts to the dull business of departmental pencil counting. How much money the department spent on wine, how much its offices and furniture are worth, and so on and so forth. So, something here is seriously out of kilter. It seems to me there is a danger that increasingly inward-looking MPs are inadvertently giving the impression of inhabiting a parallel universe immune to the changes going on in the world around them. If the days appear to be over when the Commons was taken seriously as a forum for the debate of world affairs, MPs arguably have no one but themselves to blame. As Dennis McShane, a former Labour minister in the Foreign Office, wrote this week in House magazine, MPs are becoming more and more like constituency social workers. So, to sum up, the age of WikiLeaks, in my view, owes its existence in large part to the fact that the Fourth Estate and Parliament have ceased in any meaningful way to scrutinise foreign affairs. My guess is that the age of WikiLeaks will last for as long as that remains the case.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm now going to call on Gideon Raffman.
Thank you very much.
Sitting down or standing up, whichever.
I'll stand. Sorry, okay. Well, I was thinking about WikiLeaks this morning in preparation for this debate, and it struck me that it's a good test, a litmus test of character. Your reaction to WikiLeaks probably is a good way of telling whether you're a liberal or a reactionary. And I discovered that I'm a reactionary because my initial reaction to WikiLeaks was that this was an outrage and it obviously shouldn't be allowed to happen, and that how could diplomats be expected to do their work if it all ended up on the internet? But then I thought a little further, and I realized as well as being a reactionary, I'm also a hypocrite, because this is what journalists do all the time. Indeed, it's what I had done as a journalist, try to get hold of secrets and publish them. All that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are doing is simply doing this on an absolutely industrial, unprecedented scale. But you know, if I think back at my journalistic career, I wasn't particularly good at getting scoops, which is probably why I ended up in commentary, but you know, in my time, I had managed to get hold of some minutes of British minutes, actually, of a European Council meeting, the end of the Nice summit, and to publish them in The Economist. And I can now reveal that I found them in a rubbish bin. It's probably fairly disreputable, but nobody at The Economist said, "How did you get hold of this?" Nobody said we shouldn't be publishing this. They published it because it was a story. And the reason that there's such outrage about Assange is simply that he has gone through the world's rubbish bins, courtesy of his informant, and published all this stuff. Now, the United States is outraged by this and is indeed trying to prosecute him. But actually, I think one of the paradoxical results of WikiLeaks is that it's been largely beneficial to American foreign policy, although I have difficulty of persuading my American diplomat friends of this. It does seem to me that inadvertently, because I don't think Assange is a particular friend of the United States, has debunked years of conspiracy theories about American foreign policy. Because the assumption on the left here, and indeed around the world, is that whatever the Americans were saying in public, presumably there was some sort of secret agenda behind it, and that this was all kind of hypocritical mask for advancing the interests of Halliburton or promoting some plot to overthrow a foreign government or whatever. And you could see this reflected in fiction. If I think of BBC television serials that I've watched over the years, there's always, you know, the American embassy is a rather sinister place in British fiction. But it turns out that when you leak all these documents, and again, if you'd said to me they're going to leak all these American documents, I would have predicted there would have been demonstrations outside American embassies across the world, because there would be terrible stuff that would come out and people would be sort of burning the American flag, and in fact nothing happened, because in fact what came out was entirely to America's credit. It turned out, amazingly, that what they say in private is actually what they say in public. So that there was no terrible scare. I mean, of course, There are one or two things which are embarrassing, the stealing of credit card numbers at the UN. This is pretty small stuff. It's certainly not enough to get anybody marching in the streets. And more broadly, on the broad outlines of policy, if you look at the big issues facing America, if you look at, say, China, Iran, and the Middle East, essentially, the cables reveal that, amazingly enough, the diplomats were pursuing what they said their policy was. So if you look at John Huntsman's cables from China, the ambassador is now, in fact, running for the presidency, essentially the line is that America is worried about Chinese policy on a range of commercial and strategic issues, but is intent on building a positive relationship with China. And that is what America says in public, but that is not what the Chinese blogosphere thought that American foreign policy was. They would have been absolutely convinced that there was a kind of secret American plot to do down China. Well, there may be, but it's certainly not revealed in these private diplomatic cables. In fact, I don't think there is. Again, on Iran, the American position is that, well, they're worried about Iran's nuclear program, but they would prefer, very much prefer, not to have a, quote, military solution to that. That's what they say in public. It turns out what they're also saying in private, and that the people who are actually pushing for more radical action turn out to be the Saudis. Corruption. Again, a lot of people, I think, would have assumed that when the Americans said, you know, we're opposed to corruption, foreign countries, even friendly countries, that this was a kind of pro forma declaration, but that, you know, behind the scenes they were a lot more cynical and didn't really mind. In fact, if you look at it through the WikiLeaks cables in country after country, ambassadors are reporting corruption, saying it's a problem, and it turns out that they were being rather prescient. So the American ambassador in Tunis, according to WikiLeaks, wrote in 2009, "The problem here is clear. Tunisia has been ruled by the same president for 22 years. Corruption in the inner circle is rising. Even average Tunisians are keenly aware of it." Very prescient, as it turns out, and as Joe would also point out, not something you would read in any newspaper because nobody had got a foreign correspondent there. So you know, the American ambassador, it turns out, was doing his job both in terms of being aware of the situation and in being concerned about the right issues. And therefore, I think, actually, insofar as it's had any effect on America and the Middle East, it's been a positive effect. I think it's very striking that the WikiLeaks leaks have played a part in destabilizing these governments, that when people, I mean, of course, Tunisians were aware that their government was corrupt and despotic, but to have the United States ambassadors actually saying this gave them something that they could point to. And therefore, rather than the Americans being embarrassed by these leaks, it turns out that it is governments that have something to hide that have tended to be pretty furious about what's going on, so that, for example, you get the furious reaction of Vladimir Putin in Russia. Again, as Joe said, there are all these things that are sort of known, that are discussed privately, and there's long been discussion as to whether Putin is enriching himself. But if the Americans had ever said that publicly, it would have been regarded as a massive affront to Russia. It would have been used for nationalist purposes in Russia, and it would have caused a diplomatic incident. So fair enough, they couldn't say that. But when it turns out that, in fact, they are saying this privately, that there's quite informed speculation on how this might be going on, of course, it's enormously damaging to Vladimir Putin. Indeed, the left, it turns out, is so disappointed by the lack of evidence of American double-dealing in WikiLeaks that a whole new conspiracy theory has sprung up. But if you read the Guardian's commenters free section, there's quite an extensive correspondence about whether WikiLeaks is in fact a put-up job by the Americans, because they can't be this innocent and disingenuous. Presumably they must be doing something really terrible, and this is all a kind of very sophisticated American propaganda operation. As far as I can work out, that isn't the case, because as I say, although I have tried to make this case to American diplomats that actually they should be quite pleased with Julian Assange, I even wrote an article suggesting they give him a medal. I've not found many takers for this argument. They seem to be genuinely outraged and to be trying to pursue him through the force of the law. I think it does raise an interesting question of how should one react to WikiLeaks. I'm reasonably sympathetic to what WikiLeaks did, although not necessarily to Assange as a person. He doesn't sound like particularly easy person to deal with, or perhaps a particularly nice person to deal with, but I think that, as I say, it would be hypocritical for a journalist to object to the publication of official secrets. That's what journalists, in some sense, do. Now, of course, there should be breaks, and indeed I understand that WikiLeaks did attempt, or at least The Guardian, when in publishing WikiLeaks, attempted not to publish anything that would put anyone's life in danger, and I personally, I think perhaps where WikiLeaks didn't show restraint, but it's a question for debate, if there are particularly sensitive negotiations going on that you could blow out of the water to free a hostage, to make a breakthrough in the Middle East peace process, I think even as a journalist there is a case for holding back, although reasonable people can disagree about it. But I think that although I would defend Assange's rights to do what he did, if it doesn't sound too paradoxical, I think I can also see the case for the Americans pursuing him through legal means, because I think what you're seeing actually is the clash of two important principles. The first principle is the right in a free society to publish things, even things that the government is trying to keep secret. In fact, perhaps particularly things that the government is trying to keep secret. But the other is the right of governments to try to do their job effectively, and that must mean, as a diplomat, that quite often you have to do things quietly, you have to do things confidentially, because otherwise you cannot get to the point where you can perhaps resolve a difficult issue if you're having to make all your moves, all your chess moves in public. I think these are both valid principles, and the boundaries as to which principle should prevail and when can only really be drawn by the law. And that is why we have laws to protect freedom of speech, but also in our country an Official Secrets Act, and some equivalent in the United States. And in the end, it would be up to the courts and behind them the legislatures to decide where to draw the line.
Thank you very much, Gideon. I'm now going to call David Richmond to be our third and final panellist.
Excuse me. I'm not sure if my presence on this panel as a former Director General of Defence and Intelligence in the Foreign Office is intended to inject a note of scepticism or mount a robust defence of the virtues of secrecy. Certainly it's not too difficult to think why some recent developments might not be unmitigated good news for diplomats. But while it's possible to argue about the merits of WikiLeaks, and the rise of the new media, and I include in all that but Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and so on, perhaps the first point to make is that they are part of a process which cannot be reversed. Politicians and diplomats, like everyone else, are going to have to learn to live in and adapt to a new, more transparent world. This is not just the results of WikiLeaks and the social media. Even before the advent of the internet, democracies were set on giving the public greater access to information. The UK's Freedom of Information Act coincided with the rise of the internet, but was conceived independently of it. And in the UK as well, the growth of judicial review and enforced disclosure of evidence in cases like Binyam Mohammed have probably opened up the workings of government, including the most secret workings, more than the internet. Nevertheless, we should not underestimate the changes taking place, and not surprisingly, these are most striking in places where freedom of information has been curtailed. There is a debate going on about how important a role social media, Facebook and so on, played in events in Egypt and Tunisia. But there is not much doubt that we saw something new. Social media allowed citizens not just to be consumers of information, but to share that information, to connect with others and to organise. The death at the hands of the police of an Egyptian activist, Khalid Saeed, September last year, I think, resulted in a Facebook group entitled We Are All Khalid Saeed, with 500,000 members. This group helped to organise and publicise the 25th of January Day of Rage, which kicked off the protest movement. The gathering storm seems to have been swept along by a combination of social media and traditional media like Al Jazeera, who broadcast coverage of the demonstrations, some of it provided by the demonstrators themselves, who took photos and videos on their phones and uploaded them onto social networking sites. By the time the authorities shut down the internet, and later the mobile networks, it was too late. So social media networks allow citizens to realise that they are not alone, giving them the courage and the opportunity to act. As such, these networks appear to be well suited to single-issue campaigns. Given the right political and economic conditions, they've helped mobilise the protest movements we've seen in the Middle East. But how effective will they be when it comes to what happens next? Decisions about how these countries should now move forward are complex and contested. And it will be interesting to see what role the new media, social media, will play in helping to formulate those decisions. Looking perhaps a little bit more broadly beyond the Middle East, access to more information and greater transparency should lead to better informed citizens. This in turn should mean more accountability and more participation, which should strengthen democratic processes. John Kampfner, writing recently in The Guardian about WikiLeaks, said that the days when governments and corporations believed they had a right to secrecy to protect their narrow interests or save them embarrassment are gone. But does freedom of information mean an information free-for-all? A free-for-all in which anything can or should be made publicly available, regardless of whether there might be justifications for maintaining confidentiality or privacy. This is the clash of principles Gideon's mentioned. If well-informed citizens are good for democracy, is transparency good for diplomacy and government? There's obviously a case for whistleblowing, leaking aimed at exposing errors and abuses of power. WikiLeaks does have some creditable achievements in this area. But the release of 250,000 State Department cables, judging admittedly by the very small fraction we've seen so far, does not appear to be about whistleblowing. These cables have not shown the US government up to its neck in conspiracies and cover-ups and abuses of power. What they have brought to public view is, by and large, as Gideon has suggested, the normal traffic of diplomacy, information that governments prefer to keep confidential for the sake of their working relationships with other governments. This seems to me to raise some legitimate concerns. And here I think it's worth recalling the exemptions built into the Freedom of Information Act. These include national security, defence, international relations, and the formulation of government policy. Negotiating with other governments, finding compromises, or working out the details of domestic policy will always be more difficult if everything is exposed to public scrutiny. Getting diplomats to speak frankly or advisers to give candid advice will be impossible if their confidences cannot be respected. And without frank speaking, the quality of information on which governments must base their decisions deteriorates. There are therefore, in my view at least, good practical reasons why those freedom of information exemptions were written into the Act. I said we cannot turn back the tide. Much of the social media revolution has the potential to improve democratic accountability and participation. More information can and should be made available through what I would describe as legitimate channels, and government should be exposed when they abuse their power or make mistakes. But governments are nevertheless justified in trying to keep some of what they do confidential. In the wake of WikiLeaks, the American, and indeed every other government, will be busy improving their cyber security. But since no security arrangements are likely to be entirely leak-proof, I suspect that one adaptation to recent events is that some highly sensitive discussions are going to take place without detailed records, or indeed without any records at all. The cause of transparency may not have it all its own way.